The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
My next guest is absolutely indefatigable. He has written dozens of books. He's written about people like Robert Maxwell, about Branson, about Al-Fayed, about Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, among many. He has now turned his attention to the royal family. His latest book is called Revenge, subtitled Meghan, Harry and the War Between the Windsors. Tom Bower, good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
History, you have said, was in your mother's milk. Explain.
Well, I was brought up in a home, a very small flat, one-room flat, and then a two-room flat, where politics was discussed constantly because my parents were refugees from pre-war Europe, from Hitler. And they were fascinated by history, both European history and the amazing things that happened in the world after the Second World War. So for me, politics, history, human reactions, human motives was all part of the daily mix. And so when I just studied law and then gave up being a lawyer, and journalism and writing became natural to me. And I loved it ever since. I've been very lucky.
Yeah, and you have harked back to the Second World War in several of your tomes, but the latest one is about the courtship, I suppose, of Harry and Meghan, their marriage and the fallout from it. There's an expression we use in this country. Meghan Markle, she, from your book, sounds like a bit of a dose.
A bit of a what?
A dose.
That's an excuse. What does that mean?
She is not very likable at all.
Oh, well, I think she's likable to those people who she wants herself to be liked. I mean, she objectively she can be pretty unpleasant, and clearly, her father and her friends and her former husband, who are all ghosted, have a different view of her. They find her, as did her Canadian boyfriend, the chef. Cory Vitiello, they found her in the end quite awful because she's ruthless in her treatment of people who don't do what she wants. But when she wants to be nice, she is doleful and charming, and she's very good looking and plays on her looks. And of course, as an actress, knows exactly how to press the right buttons.
Now, you suggest in your book that, and sounds fanciful, but that she really always wanted to be a princess.
Well, I don't think it's fanciful at all. I mean, her father brought her up as a princess. I mean, he told me when I went to visit him in Mexico, his greatest mistake was spoiling her rotten and treating her as a princess and giving her everything she wanted and much more. And so she was used to getting her own way. She also once said to him, as they were walking down a red carpet at an Oscar ceremony where he was receiving a prize as an Emmy for his lighting direction, that is exactly what she wanted. She wanted to spend her life walking down the red carpet. And I think that's to her credit, on her terms, that she worked so hard that she finally made it. Been rejected and humiliated so many times on the way. But then she was given star status, and she's now a world icon, which is just what she wanted to be.
You suggest, though, that she walked on so many people along the way, you know, not looking behind her when she ghosted people. She had an agent, and at one point she says to the agent, now that I'm, you know, Harry's girlfriend, fiancé, whatever, I want you to work for me, but I'm not going to pay you.
Yes, I mean, she believed... She was entitled. I mean, there's an entitlement, a sense of entitlement, which she inherited, thinking that she was a Hollywood star once she was in Canada. And the chapter in the book about the two-day shoot for Reitman's clothing store shows that. And she just felt she was famous and therefore should be given things for nothing. And that, of course, she carried through in her days and life at Kensington Palace. And, of course, it ended in tears because you have to work for what you get. And she didn't really want to put either the effort or the commitment into being part of the royal team.
Now, I was amazed to find in the early pages of your book a friend of mine, a man called John Fitzpatrick, who is a hotelier in New York City. And John actually helped Meghan Markle climb up the social ladder?
Oh, I think that the discovery of John Fitzpatrick is fascinating. I mean, as you know, he's a charming hotelier, very, very prominent in Anglo-Irish and Irish affairs, very much more famous as a sponsor and supporter of the Clintons. And her introduction to Fitzpatrick, in my view, was one of the turning points of her life, because not only did he introduce her to a great life in New York, but also to the Clintons, and Hillary Clinton in particular, who helped Meghan get into the Democratic Party fold and family, and helped her get a job with the United Nations, and then gave her advice, gave her status. And I think that opened her eyes hugely, but it opened it because she wanted to be part of that political life and family. So Fitzpatrick can take credit in many ways for a lot. And of course, he took her to the White House, where she met President Obama. And that, of course, was a very, very seminal moment for Meghan. How exciting for an unknown actress to suddenly be in that ferment. And John Fitzpatrick made that possible for her.
Now, she left many friends behind. Her best pals were ghosted, didn't hear from her. But she's still pals with John, it appears, and he went to see her in Kensington Palace. And once the courtiers and the footmen left the room, they gossiped and chatted as old friends do.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that, of course, that happened when she was in Kensington Palace. Whether they see each other now, I don't know. Unfortunately, I tried to talk to John Fitzpatrick, but he'd gone through a series of accidents and then got COVID, and it just didn't happen. My suspicion is that she doesn't see John Fitzpatrick now, but I mean, I don't know the answer.
Sure.
But I think that, you know, the point about her ghosting people, I mean, she does use people, and very foolishly doesn't realize that a politician should never leave a bad impression when you leave. And that's what's on the whole so clever about the royal family, that they make everyone feel good, whether they like the person or not. And Meghan did the opposite. She created a lot of anger, as the book shows.
No.
She left a trail of bad relations, and that wasn't very clever of her.
Her pursuit of Harry, I mean, you can't really pursue a prince, but you can put yourself in the way of things, shall we say, and that's really what happened. Someone organised a date for them.
Well, you can pursue people. I mean, I do think, I mean, I use the word, and I think I use it advisedly. Meghan was on a manhunt. I mean, she'd been to England many times after 2013, looking for an English husband. I mean, she asks fellow actresses and actors if they know a suitable man who she could meet with the prospect of marrying. I mean, she chased for some time Ashley Cole, the footballer. She chased many people, apparently. And I think that the introduction to Harry was very carefully plotted by her and very carefully researched for the first drink that she knew what to say to make Harry interested in her. I mean, there's nothing that happens by chance in Meghan's life. Her whole life has been very carefully planned. And when she has the failures, to her credit, she picks herself up, or depict herself up, and went on ahead. And, you know, she had many setbacks on her Hollywood career. But I think that's to her credit, that she is a tough, ruthless, ambitious woman. I say that meaning it well, not in any way critical. The tragedy for her is that she hurt so many people on that route and could have avoided that if only she had been more generous.
Did she understand that although the royal family is constantly, I suppose, treated like it's a showbiz soap opera, that the reality is very different to the way Hollywood works?
Well, I think that you put your finger on it. She thought it was all celebrity, which is why it was an extraordinary guest list at the Windsor wedding in 2018, with all these Hollywood stars. Her life, she thought the royal life was all about being in the spotlight and campaigning and being applauded. She loved all that. She didn't realize that on the other side, the real side of the royal work, is visiting very, very deprived areas, going to places where there are no cameras, where you just bring a bit of happiness and reassurance and support to people, which is very much what the Queen and Prince Charles and Princess Anne do. I mean, they do dozens and dozens of visits to hospitals, hospices, schools and things, just to reassure people of their value to the community. Now, Meghan clearly was not interested in that. She only wanted to go to celebrity spots, Wimbledon, theatre, parties and things like that, and that isn't part of the royal duties.
Did she understand the fallout that would occur after they exited Great Britain for a life in America?
Well, the answer is only she can answer that, because whether she anticipated what happened, I'm not sure, except the following. There's no doubt she knew that leaving London was going to cause huge problems for the royal family. And there's no doubt she did it because she did it in her own, purely in her own interest. She wanted to go back and live in California. I didn't think she ever really wanted to live in Britain. But the interview with Oprah Winfrey was so vindictive. It was so calculated to cause damage. It was such an act of revenge against a family who hadn't given her what she wanted. So, and also put her on the map. I mean, gave her enormous global publicity because of what she said, and many of those things she said just weren't true, especially about the racism and the marriage and things like that. So I think it was very much calculated and plotted. She has a very experienced team of publicity advisors in Sunshine Saks. She recruits talented people to work with her. So nothing happened by chance in Meghan's life after leaving. The question now really is whether in what I think a make or break year for them, it'll turn out that she can get the fame and fortune she needs the rest of her life. The Netflix documentary series and Harry's book will be decisive both for their income and their status. And that will make my book, I think, in that sense, important, because it sets the scene for this make or break moment.
When you talk about income, I mean, the thing about an income is it has to be repeated year in, year out, unless, you know, you win a multi-million lottery or something like that, and you've got a nest egg that'll do you for life. The kind of lifestyle that they have, the protections that are required and so on, is expensive.
Well, I think that's exactly the point. I mean, some people think it's costing them 4 or 5 million euros or dollars a day, a year. And that sort of money is very hard to earn just by appearances. And I think that is a problem they face, that unless they earn stupendous amounts from the book and the Netflix film, I just don't see how they're going to get the sort of income they need to sustain their lifestyle. This vast mansion in Montecito, the private jets, I mean, just to fly to London, return from L.A., would have set them back at least $500,000 when they came for the Jubilee. So it's not easy for them, and that is going to be their challenge. I mean, the point is, you see, their predecessor, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, did have money problems always, but they did have the support of their family in England to keep them going when they hit hard times. I can't see Prince Charles sending any more money across to California.
Yeah. You point out that the Jubilee celebrations, where the Queen was clearly high in the affection of her subjects, most of them at any rate, that the Harry and Meghan entourage were kind of somewhat out in the cold. They were bit players rather than the main cast.
Well, yes, and I think that was very much for once, the palace played it right, because clearly they intended to only come on their terms, which was part of this whole story of Harry saying he couldn't come unless he got proper protection, etc. And they wanted to be on the balcony, and they wanted to be centrepiece at St. Paul's, and they wanted to be cheered by the crowds for their Netflix film, and clearly wanted to be photographed with the Queen. And none of that happened. And that was very skillfully managed by, in my view, Charles and Prince William, deciding on how they were going to limit it, and the staff arranging it in such a way that they were consigned to the periphery without photographs. And if I can just tell me this, but they did try very cleverly, in a way, to usurp this plan, because they were meant to, for the St. Paul's ceremony, the church attendance, to join the rest of the lesser royals, in the coach and arrive all together. But they arrived deliberately late at the Wellington barracks, apparently, so that they would arrive at St. Paul's in their own car and could stand for some time on the steps with the greeting party. And that was very clever because they got the right photographs for that. They got the right footage. But then, of course, inside St. Paul's, they were seated way out of line from the royal family, which is not what they wanted. So it has been carefully managed. And I think now the royal officials and family were planning what to do, how to react better to Harry's book, which potentially could contain some very awful bombshells for the royal family, and cope with it better than they did when Meghan did the Oprah Winfrey interview.
Well, the book is called Revenge, subtitled Meghan, Harry and the War Between the Windsors. It's published by Blink and its author, Tom Bower. Tom, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.